The professor is with us, the bench coach of the Giants, Ron Wotus, on this Sunday morning. Only a couple more weeks to go, Woe.
Yeah, we're winding down, aren't we? It's good to be here with you, Marty. You know, and keeping with the hot dog theme here a little bit, we had hot dogs in the clubhouse yesterday, so I was excited to see that. We pushed the kale aside and the brown rice, and we actually had hot dogs after batting practice. So that was a nice change. And, you know, you're talking about what will happen. Well, today's the day where Ryan Vogelsong going to take the mound before Chris Stratton.
That's
so here you go again. Chris Stratton is involved with a unique situation where he's not going to go out on the mound to begin with. It's going to be Ryan Vogelsong to take some warm-ups.
I forgot about that. Very good. Yeah, because we had him on yesterday. That's a good segue into this Ryan Vogelsong. And, you know, we had him on yesterday with Nicole, who is a wonderful person. And one of the key wives, when new people would show up, she really made people feel well. I love her. Very nice. So they were both on with me yesterday, and it's nice to have him back. And we talked about some of his moments. And I'll ask you some of the better moments with him. But he had a certain personality on the day he pitched. Now, you're a guy, when I get in the clubhouse, you're walking around the clubhouse, you got your pieces of paper, you're showing it to everybody, you're waving, you're moving around, you know, you're like, you know, the Mad Hatter getting through the clubhouse. This guy was different on the day he pitched.
Yeah. Well, he's notorious for his game face, right? And, you know, as a coach, too, you never want to bother, at least I never have. I don't want to bother the starting pitcher on a day that he is pitching. So if you want to go over signs or a play or something in particular, you want to do it before. You don't want to approach him the day he's pitching. Now, Ryan, on the other hand, you definitely want to stay away because he'd have his head down, he'd have his game face on, and he wanted to focus at the task at hand. And he was well known for that, and he carried that demeanor out onto the mound for as long as he was on the mound.
And he was a guy that the teammates understood this because we had a few of the teammates talk yesterday about him. And every one of them went to that.
Yeah.
In a way that, you know, they said, look, we would not mess with the guy. You know, we love him, but we were not going to mess around with him.
Right. Well, everybody's different. You know, you have, 12, 13 pitchers on the staff and over the years starters. Some starters, you go talk to them, it's just another day. You know, you can discuss whatever you want. They're joking. They're having a good time. So everybody prepares a little bit differently. Ryan was one extreme. Other guys are on the other extreme, maybe just having a good time. And there's guys, most of them are probably somewhere in the middle. But I agree with you. It's a great moment for him today. It's great to see Nicole and Ryan back here. Certainly one of my favorites, having been drafted with the Giants and then, you know, leaving to Pittsburgh and then coming back and us winning two World Series with him. It's just great memories that we'll always have together.
Yeah, what about his games that you remember? And we're going to play one of the greatest games in Giants history today, and it's going to be the game against Colorado when he came back here. He had already won a game on the road. This is 2011. And they got his first start on Mother's Day.
Yeah.
And he went out and pitched five perfect innings before Iannetta got a base hit and crowd went wild. What do you remember about that day?
Well, you know, I don't remember that particular day quite as much, but what I remember about Vogie is the fierce competitor. And, you know, he kept the ball out of the middle of the plate.
Okay.
There was a time where his stuff was really pretty good, and there was a time where his stuff wasn't the best, but he got the most out of what he had. He kept the ball on the black of the plate, and he would not give in. And that's what made him very, very successful. He did not throw the ball down the middle of the plate and give in to a hitter. And that mentality, that competitiveness, has given him a tremendous career.
He pitched some big games in the postseason, and I think Crawford pointed it out to me yesterday. Vogelsong had a game he started. The Giants had never lost a postseason game he started.
Wow.
Well, how about the Cincinnati game? Remember the game three?
Right. Well, you make legend with things like that, you know, when you rise to the occasion. And, you know, Ryan certainly did it. We had other guys do it, too, or we wouldn't be sitting here with three world championships with the clubs that we had. You know, I mean, it wasn't like we steamrolled the league in any of those years, but everybody elevated their game when they needed to. Everybody put the performances in. And Ryan was one of those guys. I'll tell you, you know, he was so competitive. He actually got me thrown out of a game one time. One of the umpires, you know, I thought that they were squeezing Ryan, so I yelled at the umpire, you know, both ways, Sammy. The umpire looks over, whatever. Ryan glances in the dugout. He's sneering at the umpire. Next thing you know, I'm out of the game. So Ryan brought that out on the mound for everybody around him, the players behind him. You know, it's like Sharks, Samardzija for us right now, Bumgarner, these great pitchers, when they take the mound, the players on the field, they know they have to be ready to play. And you need that type of leadership and determination from everybody. So it's great to have those guys on the club.
Yeah, great point. Very good point. The professor, he's always got it down. Very good. The bench coach, Ron Wotus. So Ryan told us he's going to go to the Instructional League. And he's going to see how it feels maybe to work with the young pitchers and all that. Then decide with the organization if he wants to go further. So my question to you is, you becoming a coach, when did it sort of come together for you? Because this is new for him. He doesn't know what he's getting into.
Right.
And you must have gone through something like that when you first got into it.
Yeah, no question. I was bouncing around back in Triple A. My major league career was somewhat over, and I had arm surgery when I was in the big league. So I went back to the minor leagues, and I was playing. I was playing Triple A ball, and I was playing with the Orioles in Kansas City, and then I ended up signing with the Giants here. Carlos Alfonso was the farm director. I signed over here as a Giant, and I played two seasons in Triple A for him, and I couldn't throw the ball. I didn't feel I was going to get back to the major leagues. And that winter, I had an opportunity to, go to camp with the Mets in Triple A again, or go to Anzio Beach in the Italian League, which I considered a little bit, or Carlos Alfonso offered me a coaching job in the Giants organization. Yeah. So there I was, 29 years old, and said, what am I going to do? And I felt like my arm was never going to get me back to the major leagues, and I decided to make a career switch. And I did do that. And went to Clinton, Iowa my first year with the great Jack Mull, who was a minor league manager. And that was my first year coaching. And then from there, I progressed to managing the next 6 years in the organization.
So what was it like becoming a coach for the first time? And now you're still a young man, and the players are not that much younger than you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's an adjustment. You think you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
You're a little bit of a hothead. Right. I mean, you still have that competitive fire in you, and you do your job a lot of time the way you did your job as a teammate, as a player. And it's a little bit different. I think the more you do it, the more you understand how important it is to be there for the player, for their needs, to get them the work, to give them the support, and to believe in them. And it just evolves. But it's a unique time. You love the game, so you want to stay into it. And in a lot of ways, it's exciting because now you have a new career. When you're done playing, it's a difficult time. Yeah. You know, you love it so much. You've been playing since you were a little leaguer, and now it's over. And a lot of guys don't know what they want to do for a living. So here you are, you're still in the game, but now your whole mind starts thinking a different way, and you have a new career. And I think as athletes, we need something to keep us going, and that certainly does.
Well, I think so, because let's face it, the guys today make money. You know, they're all millionaires. They don't have to get on
right.
the bus and deal with a 19-year-old who says, I throw it this way. What are you telling me? So you really have to be dedicated.
Well, that's a good point. And I think we probably would have a lot more, not Hall of Famers per se, but long-careered major leaguers coaching in the minor leagues. But to the point that you made, there's no money in it.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of sacrifice. So, you have your family, your kids, and now you're going to leave all that for 6 years in Pocatello, Idaho, and 2 days off all year on the buses. It's a huge sacrifice.
Yeah.
So a lot of guys like Ryan, if they can get into it, test the waters, do some instructional league and do a part-time thing, a lot of guys choose to go that route to see just how much they want to do that.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. You don't make the big money as a coach until you get to the big leagues.
Right.
And then you really cash in.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We really cash in. Once you get to the big leagues, it's I'm thinking of, I should have retired about 10 years ago.
Is Mark Gardner laughing as I say that right now?
Yeah, he certainly is. There's no doubt about
that.
But
you get free food.
Free food.
I guess it's free.
Well, the clubhouse dues are down now, right? We got, so it's a little bit cheaper, and the food keeps getting better, so that's a good deal.
You know, football, it's interesting. Football. After the game, they have a big meal for the families and the players. You know, it's a different kind of thing. See this coming in baseball? All of a sudden, you know, because things are so different now. They got a masseuse in there. Really, the players, it's not like Orlando Cepeda. We'll talk about him in a minute coming up in 1958. Pretty soon you'll have, after the game, you'll have the family dinner, you know?
Yeah, no.
No, it's not.
I don't see it coming.
All
no.
right.
Every
All
day
right.
that we do this, yeah, we have a big meal in there every day. The guys that choose to eat it, but yeah, I don't see it happening in baseball. But hey, you never know.
You don't. Come on, the way the game is going. You mentioned one other thing before we get off the vocal song stuff. He will go to the instructional league, and the word instructional league. You know, it's not the fall league. It's not winter ball. It's the instructional league. What are they? Have you been there? What do they do down there?
Yeah. Well, I've been there about three times as a player, as a young player when I was first drafted by the Pirates. You have your regular season, and then a lot of times they send the prospects to instructional league if you're not going to winter ball.
Yeah.
It's usually your younger A ball, you know, rookie ball guys that are just drafted. It could be double A guys, but usually the double A or triple AAA guys, if they want them to keep playing, they would go to winter ball, you know, to Latin America or Mexico, Dominican, or these places. So you take your young players to give them more instruction and to work with them more. And when you call it instructional league, back when I was involved with it, you know, you didn't worry about the wins and the losses of the games. That's irrelevant. You went there to work on something specific. So let's say you can really hit and you're having a hard time fielding the ball at shortstop. You'd go down there and you'd work with the infield guys and maybe do everything you can to improve your defense. So you try to get more specific and give them what they need. A pitcher maybe is working on a secondary pitch, work on his breaking ball, and then they try to use that in the game more. You know, so now you have a game scenario where you can use it. It got to the point with base stealers, we'd have base stealers down there, and you'd play a game. This is years ago, and I don't know if they still do it a lot now, but if you had to, you know, like the Darren Ford on your club prospect, a guy would get a hit, you'd actually run your base stealer to first base and let him see if he can steal the base. So both teams had this in agreement that we're going to try to develop these guys and try to get the most out of them in that regard.
More like going to school rather than, you know, real competitive games, I guess.
Well, you know, I think they are competitive games still, but they had this agreement that they would do things like that years ago.
Sure.
In today's game, probably should talk to Shane Turner and Decker. Yeah. I don't think it's quite at that level, but hence the name Instructional League. And I know going way back, talking to Joe LaFay, who was here and came up with the Yankees, you know, Derek Jeter made, I don't know if it was 40 errors one year.
He made like 50, I think.
Yeah. It might have been a high 50s. Yeah. Anyways, the Yankees sent him to Instructional League, never swung the bat, just played defense the whole time. So things like that can transpire down there.
I was sitting around in the stands the other day with a couple of scouts, and they brought up the name Derek Jeter. And he was number one on the board for the Houston Astros. And the owner said, I don't want a high school kid.
Yeah.
And that was the end of that.
That was the end of that. Well, it was different philosophies. Yeah. Obviously, when I was drafted, there seemed to be a lot more high school kids drafted than college guys. But every situation is different. Houston obviously wanted a player closer to the major leagues that can impact them right away.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was it. But I thought that was an interesting story. They said, no, we don't want that guy. All right, good luck. Now he owns the Marlins.
Yeah, well, we have a couple here, you know. I don't know if you realize, and I was hoping he'd come on this morning. Bill Hayes was drafted ahead of Cal Ripken.
That's true. Huh?
You
know that. He was down in the basement when his mother yelled down, hey, you got drafted.
Yeah.
I know, it's like Wayne's World. That's what I picture Bill Hayes.
That's a great story. And, of course, we'll never forget that about Billy because we like to rib him. You were drafted before the guy that has a league named after him? Anyways.
Very good. Hey, Ray Durham is around. They showed him on the big board the other day. And what do you remember about Ray Durham?
Oh, I loved Ray. He brings a smile to your face. Very talented player. You know, he was very dynamic offensively. He could do it all. He could hit for power. He could steal a base. Gave us some good years. And it was fun to see him in the clubhouse yesterday and, you know, really shocked me talking to him as he moved out here to California, and he moved to a place that I know well, Truckee, California, and he's from North Carolina. So I said, Ray, I don't think you're going to make it through one winter up there. So I don't know if he knows exactly what he's in for, but he's been up there a month, and the guys love seeing him, obviously. Ray was a favorite of ours.
Yeah, when he was in Oakland, we used to call him the Ghost. Because you can never interview him. He was like Freddie Sanchez. Freddie Sanchez was the rabbit, the white rabbit.
Yeah.
He'd be going, Freddie, can we talk to you? I'll be right back, you know, as he was moving. Well, this guy, Ray Durham, you couldn't find him.
Yeah.
He was the ghost.
He would
disappear.
He knew where to hide.
Yeah, he
knew how to make his way around and keep to himself. He really was a pretty private person, all in all. Great guy. But you had to get to know him a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. I thought he was a heck of a hitter. Come on, a switch hitter.
Was.
Power.
Yeah, he was.
Yeah,
power,
Ray Durham
speed.
Had his moments.
He sure did.
Yeah, he had his moments. Another guy in the box score the other day, Dan Runsler. I don't know if you guys watched the box score, but he's pitching for the Pirates, and I don't think he's given up a run yet. Allie or Carmen, look up Dan Runsler. Just see what he's done. I don't think he's given up a run yet. How about that? Dan Runsler's back.
That's great to see. I don't recall off the top of my head what was his first year here, but a guy that we gave every opportunity to, left-handed pitcher who threw 96. And those guys are going to get every opportunity. And he had some good moments with us, but he was never consistent enough to hold down that starting job or that bullpen job. And he must have been, last time he pitched in the big leagues, it has to be 4, 5, 6 years ago, I would think. So to persevere like that and to be back in the major leagues, my hat's off to him.
Carmen, grab the mic from Will for a second and just tell us what's going on with Runsler there.
Looks like he's pitched 2 innings, 2 hits, 1 walk, 2 strikeouts, no runs.
No runs for Runsler. All right.
That's good to see. Dan Runsler.
Yeah.
Good luck, Danny. Yeah.
Yeah. If you're a lefty, I say this all the time, if you're a lefty, you can pitch till our age.
Right. Well, you're exactly right. I don't know about our age, but close. Because you know what? If you can locate your fastball and throw a little breaking ball in the right spot, there's been a number of pitchers, obviously, we've seen over the years. You know, Runsler always threw 96, and the command was the issue. And you know how they'll hit the hard stuff here. So if the command is there and he's throwing 86, he can still get people out.
Well, you got two guys like that now, tell you the truth. And, you know, we'll see what the patience is with Osich and Okert. Big pitchers, 96.
Yeah.
But you
got
to throw the ball where you want to throw it.
Yes, you do. And you look at guys that we've had here previous to them, Javi Lopez, what he did.
Yeah.
You know, he wasn't throwing in the 90s. And location, keep the ball down. And another guy who was a great pitcher for us, Sergio Romo.
Yeah.
He never overpowered the ball, but it was location. He had that nice breaking ball, threw it in a perfect location. And you can make a nice career for yourself if you can get that done.
Yeah, I was thinking of Scott Ayer.
Scott Ayer at the end of his career, pretty good slider.
Right.
He threw in the low 90s when he first came up. You know, guys for me, Tony Fossas pitched for, I think, 40 years.
Yes, he did.
And never broke 90.
He may still
90.
Be pitching. Who knows?
Yeah, he's probably in Mexico pitching. So
Chad
much.
Zerbe.
Chad Zerbe, yeah. So there's a lot of
lefties.
Them. Yeah, lefties. You want them to be able to get a lefty out, and you could, you know, a specialist. You can pitch in this league.
Yeah. So good to see for Runsler. Ron Wotus with us, of course, the bench coach of the Giants. One other thing I'll mention to you, and that is leaving a game early. And, you know, we have this in football all the time. And I left the Cal Stanford game when the band came on the field.
Oh, boy.
I didn't leave it, but I was on my way out.
Okay.
And I saw the play from ground level. Joe Capp ran past me with his arms up like he couldn't believe it. But, you know, as an athlete, of course, you're playing in the games. But as a spectator, are you one of those guys who leaves a game early?
Well, growing up, We never did. You know, I went to a Red Sox game with my dad in Connecticut, and we drive 2 hours. We didn't leave the game early. If you were going to be stuck in traffic, you were going to be stuck in traffic, right? You're going to be there for the 2 hours getting out of the parking lot and getting onto the freeway. But as we mature and get older, I have to admit, and I don't want to admit, I have done it before, but it's usually because of the traffic. If you're in a stadium or a place where the traffic's going to be an issue and you have something to do in the morning, or you have kids, young kids with you, and they have to go to school, you know, you will leave the game early. And I don't want to say this, but I'm going to go ahead and do it. Is Warrior game a couple of times when the game is in hand, you can leave the stadium early just to get a jump on that traffic. And it's a great place to get out of because there's not a lot of traffic there. And you listen to the last 3 minutes, you know, on the radio, and the game's in hand. But the thing that you don't like is when you do something like that and something happens, to your point. The team comes back, and now you're kicking yourself for leaving the arena.
Yeah, for me, we would go to Notre Dame football games. A group of us, Michael Gaines, George Roach, Jim Collins, Ben Winslow, Tim Reardon, and we'd make one trip because Tim Reardon was a Notre Dame guy. So we'd all go, and we'd see a Cub game, or we'd go to a Blackhawk game. We'd go to Hawthorne Racetrack, and then we'd go to Notre Dame on Saturday. Well, getting out of there, if you didn't get out of there at the right moment and the right time, there was one way out of South Bend.
Oh, boy.
And it could take you 3 or 4 hours to get out. And that's the only time I said, we're going. And those Notre Dame games went right down to the end. We saw Miami play Florida State, Stanford with Bill Walsh and all that.
Yeah. You know, it's big games and big, you know, situations. It's hard to do that. But I think if you do frequent a lot of games and, you know, it's a work week, I think it happens probably more times than not.
Well, I'll tell you, last night, just before we take our first break here, Rod Wotus with us, a pleasure every Sunday morning. Last night, the crowd stayed till the end.
Yeah.
Because I was in the bunker, you know, I could see people walking past, and most of the time if I'm in here, well, you know, the crowd is thinned out already. Not last night.
Yeah.
It went right down to the end. That was that game last night. I don't know. I felt Bumgarner Greinke. That was one of those pitching matchups. It went right down to the end.
Yeah, a great matchup. Close game. You know, you're a bloop and a blast away from tying the game. Greinke. Yeah. It's the best I've seen him in a while. You know, he threw strikes with all his pitches. I mean, he's always been able to do that, but sometimes he nitpicks too much and he's on the block before you know it. He has 100 pitches in 6 innings and he's out of the game, but not last night. That's the best I've seen him throw in a while. You know, throwing 2-0 breaking balls to hitters and very difficult. He's having a good year.
Yeah, he's like Vogelsong. Vogelsong wouldn't give in until it was 3-2 with the bases loaded.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and that's the same way with this guy.
Yeah.
He won't do it. All right. Great to have Ron with us. Professor will be back. We got a couple of good questions for him. And I want to ask him if he has an Apple Watch and whether he's got one or not. We want to find out if he does. We'll do that more right after this. We're joined by the bench coach, Ron Wotus of the Giants, and the legendary scout, the legend we call him, and that is Gary Hughes. Gary, nice to have you in here with us.
Great to be in the, what do you call this, the bunker?
This is the bunker. How do you like the professor on Sunday morning?
He's wonderful. He's one I love him every Sunday and when you're around here. And he's talking about all the jobs he's done in this game. He's got another one he's got to do, too, and that's managing the big leagues.
All right. Well, we're hoping, but I think Woe is one of the best ever, so I'll tell you that. You know what I think. Hey, Allie has done her research. 1992, Derek Jeter went sixth in the draft, and number one that year, Woe? Phil Nevin.
Nev. Well, that's great to hear. I'm glad I heard this because I get to go in that clubhouse now. And not only we have Bill Hayes, we have Phil Nevin ahead of Derek Jeter. And certainly had a great career compared to mine. But I'm still going to give him a little bit of a ribbon there.
All right. Very good. Good research, Ali. Very good. Go ahead, Gary.
I just want to make sure everybody realizes scouting is not an exact science.
No, it isn't. You know, and look, Gary, of course, Gary's Sarah High School and did so many things. But Marin Catholic, right, over there in Marin, and has been a scout, one of the best ever, and we call him the legend. But do you have one that you kind of scouted and made it big, and no one else thought that was going to be the big guy? Did you have one like that other than Rex Hudler?
Rex was a first round pick. 19th round that we got, and he's well known here, Kirk Reeder. Went in the 19th round, and nobody expected me that good. And a great scouting job by our area scout, Stan Zielinski, who just passed away this year. And Kirk Reeder would be a guy that comes to mind when you ask that kind of a question.
All right.
Well, that's interesting because we know Kirk Reeder, and that makes sense. It's interesting, but makes sense, right? As a scout, you're looking for the high velocity, and you're looking for the a good spin on the breaking ball. And Woody had none of that.
No, all he did was win games.
Exactly.
So, yeah. What was it about him that attracted you to him? Because he really didn't throw very hard, and he's a lefty.
No, it was an area scout. I was a scouting director, and his area scout, Stan Zielinski, just believed in him. And he also believed that we could wait to take him. Stan was a good scout. The best ones are kind of a little quirky, and he would get mad at me if I took a guy too early. He said, "Oh, you wasted a pick. You could have waited a couple more rounds." You know, most scouts want their guy immediately. You know?
Sure.
But sometimes you wait around, and somebody else grabs the guy.
Exactly.
And has that happened with you?
Yeah. I forget the year, but I'm standing there, sitting there, the draft goes on, what do you call it? Everybody's in their own right. place, and they do it on the radio, on the television, or not
conference
television,
room, yeah.
radio. Anyhow, I have this card out, and just in front of me, the California Angels make a pick. And this was a third round pick. And so I took the card and put it down, and I said it over the thing. I says, "Well, failing to land a salmon, the Montreal Expos pick Tim Krause." Now, the only difference, the only similarity between Tim Krause and Salmon is they have the same first name. And Tim Salmon on those Montreal teams would have been, you know, we had it going pretty good there, and he would have really helped.
Oh, that's a pretty good one, Tim Salmon.
Sure, absolutely.
Absolutely. Hey, yesterday it was a big celebration at the ballpark. I want to get your guys' reaction to it. Gary Hughes with us, with Ron Wotus. Orlando Cepeda, 80th birthday. And I talked a lot about Orlando on the postgame show last night. He was the first big star of San Francisco. He was the homegrown guy of San Francisco. The newness of Major League Baseball in San Francisco, the new grass, the new everything about baseball, Russ Hodges and Lon Simmons and everything. And Orlando really was the first star, the homegrown star, and hit a home run in his first game and celebrated his 80th birthday yesterday. And I want to get your thoughts, about Orlando Cepeda.
Well, you know, he's been here around the ballpark, and actually was on the field for years with us when I first got here, and he'd help out in spring training with the first basemen. And, of course, as you said, Hall of Famer, great career. And I remember him back when I was growing up in Connecticut as a Boston Red Sox. Uh-huh. You know, when you're in the backyard playing wiffle ball, and I'd go through the whole lineup, you know, Yastrzemski and Burleson, Cepeda. And I remember the bullets he used to hit in the gap, and he was one of those guys I wanted to be when I was, you know, playing that wiffle ball. So to get here with San Francisco and be able to listen to him help coach first basemen and work alongside him is great, but he's always been a class act, always great to see in the clubhouse, and has something good to offer to the guys.
Yeah, Gary, of course you were here, you got to see Cepeda come up, and probably were you at the first game, April 15th, 1958?
No, I claimed I was boycotting because of my love for the San Francisco Seals, but actually my mother wouldn't let me miss school.
Okay.
I went to the second day, though, when Ramon Monzant pitched and beat the...
All right. Well, he hit the home run the first day off of Don Bessent, and Daryl Spencer hit the first home run for the Giants, and Cepeda hit the second. But what were your recollections of Cepeda?
Well, just being here and just seeing... I mean, the first baseman they had Cepeda, Bill White, and then up comes this guy McCovey. I mean, it's unbelievable. But the big thing I remember was the influx of Latin players, and that's credit to Horace Stoneman. I mean, out of nowhere you got the Alouz and Pagan and Cepeda, and it just kept Tito, and it just kept going and going, and it was fun. The one I remember most was when Jesus Alou came up, and nobody knew what to call him. Jesus, you know, and
Sunday you could call him.
Yeah, he became a very dear friend, and as did his brother and Felipe. I knew Matty a little bit, the other two real well, but they just kept coming, and they did a heck of a job in Scotland, Latin America, and really breaking ground there.
Well, Manny Mota, it was another one who came up. Ozzie Virgil, don't forget Juan Marichal.
Yeah.
Came up. I mean, it wasn't easy to get players out of the Dominican Republic. You had to have a rapport with the dictator, Trujillo. And it was only after Trujillo was gone in 62 that even more came to the United States. But the Giants did that. You brought up an interesting point about Horace Stoneham. And, well, I don't think you ever got to meet Horace Stoneham.
No.
But he was the owner of the Giants. And from his dad had in the early 20s, and his father passed away. And Horace kept the club until 75 or so when Bob Lurie took it, but it was a family ownership, and he was losing money, and he had to sell the team. They were going to Toronto. They were going to be Labatt's Brewery. They were going to be the Toronto Giants, and Bob Lurie stepped in with Bud Herseth, who was a cattleman who knew nothing about base, nothing, except he had money. And he helped Bob Lurie buy the team from Horace Stoneham. But Horace Stoneham, an interesting man. You don't have baseball in the West Coast in 1958 without Horace Stoneham.
Yeah.
Because O'Malley said, I'm going to Los Angeles. And he had that deal in the works for a while because he was sort of playing both ends against the middle with New York to get a state in for the Dodgers. And Horace was in the Polo Grounds. It was decaying. And he knew that it was about the end for the Polo Grounds, and he wasn't getting a new park. He was going to move the team to Minneapolis. And O'Malley said, well, wait a minute, Horace. I'm going to L.A. Why don't you go to San Francisco? And that deal was put together very quickly. So you don't have baseball out here without Horace Stoneham.
Yeah.
The other thing is the Cactus League. The Cactus League started in like 47 with Bill Veeck. Bill Veeck got divorced and he had trouble and he got remarried. And his wife said, look, I don't want you running around all winter long and all spring long. So he said, okay, I'll bring the Cleveland Indians to Tucson, where I have my ranch. And that's where spring training will be. But he needed somebody to play. And he said to Horace, why don't you come to Arizona? And Horace said, okay, I'll train in Arizona at that time. And that's the way the Cactus League started, because Cleveland Indians needed somebody to play.
Wow. And well, those are great moves for baseball in general.
Yes.
I mean, it's great to hear the history of those. And even Arizona now in spring training, you know, everybody in Florida wants to be in Arizona. And that has become the premier spot. And to think that the Giants could have ended up in Toronto, I didn't know the history of that. I certainly know that we almost ended up in Tampa Bay, trying to take this team a long ways from San Francisco. We're so glad it's still here.
So I bring it up just to digress a little bit on Sunday morning. You know, I like to do this every once in a while. But Horace Stoneham should get consideration for the Hall of Fame as an owner. Because the other thing he did, and of course the Dodgers broke the color line with Jackie Robinson in 1947, but Horace was right behind him. Horace had Monty Irvin. He had Hank Thompson at that point. He had Willie Mays at that point after the Red Sox turned their back on Mays and Jackie Robinson and everybody else. But Horace really, yes, they did. Horace really integrated the National League as well as the Dodgers did. And that's how they got Monty Irvin, because the Dodgers didn't want to pay Effa Manley, who owned the Newark Eagles, $10,000 for Monty Irvin. Branch Rickey said, I just want him. And she said, well, wait a minute. You know, he's my player. So Horace stepped up and said, I'll give you $10,000. And that's how Monty Irvin became a New York Giant. So Horace had a big part of the integration of the National League and these other things we talk about. So he gets lost in the shuffle because he was kind of a character and there's a lot of drinking going on, you know, the old stories about him. But he should get consideration for the Hall of Fame.
Wow, interesting stuff, Marty. Very interesting.
All right, let's go to Apple Watch. I don't know if Gary Hughes has an Apple Watch. He is employed by the Red Sox, but, well, you're involved with, you know, the Sean Dunstan with the, you know, the replays and all that. Red Sox had a guy in the clubhouse. This is well known. It's been documented, and they watched on the video. They got the signs from the catcher, and they texted to a guy in the dugout who had an Apple Watch, and he said the fastball's coming, and they'd scream at the hitter, and somehow they did all this in about 10 seconds. I don't know how.
Yeah.
But this is what baseball has turned into. Now, the commissioner has slapped their wrists and all that. You can't do that. But technology in baseball, yeah. And what do you think?
Well, it's a real issue. There's no doubt about it. I mean, they did it. With the replay, the video access you have now, and you have 16 cameras on that video replay. So, you know, a player's in that video room, you can get any angle you want to see what's going on. Now, in the past, you'd have to look at the TV feed, right? And they're not always showing the catcher's signs and things like that. But this has gone on forever, even before the Apple Watch and the video replay. Teams would look at video, try to get the catcher's signs, and they know before going into the game what the signs are. There's been teams doing it in the course of the game. Philadelphia was known to do it. We have Pat Burrell come over here and talk about how they would relay the signs. But bringing the Apple Watch into play ratchets it up another level because it's immediate. You don't have to go up to the clubhouse or see the signs before and then come down and tell somebody. You can relay it immediately, and now the guys on the field or the trainer in this instance, which was with the Red Sox, can relay the signs of the players on the field. So it's a real issue, and it does need to be addressed because it can happen very easily.
All right. Gary, technology, you've been around the game a long time. What do you think?
Well, as an employee of the Boston Red Sox, I'll say this, that when the fines came out, we were not the only ones fined for that. So were the Yankees, who turned us in. But it goes back and to what Ron said and to what we maybe early Giant days and stuff like that. The shot heard around the world. The Bobby Thompson. There's a whole book written about it, about an electrician that set up a system and all that. And Whitey Lockman, was the coach of the Giants for years and player prior to that, was on second base when
Thompson
hit the home run. So finally I said, okay, Lockman, I read this whole book. It's got the whole thing about it, because he would deny it. He says, I promise you I'll answer any question you have. I said, okay. So we had a beautiful dinner one night in the Pink Pony in Scottsdale with a couple of Expos, Pat Doherty and Bill Stone and myself. And we had a wonderful time. At the end, I said, okay, what about the electrician? He looks at me and he says, he hit the home run, didn't he? I said, that's your answer. And that's all he got. And three weeks later, with me in attendance, he passed away.
Yeah.
Wonderful man. But it's been going on forever, and some people say if you're not cheating, you're not trying.
Right, Gary. Well, to that point, you're exactly right. And it's going to continue to do that, and guys are still relaying signs. And I think that's why Major League Baseball, you're not supposed to have the Apple Watches in the dugout. They've given us the iPads that we use for our scouting information, but they're not live or online, and that's the difference. So I think when you get the electronics involved, and which it's against the rules, it brings it to another level. And, guys are still going to be able to watch video and relay signs on the field by getting them. The runner at second sees the signs. That can always be part of the game. But we do got to be careful with these new TVs. You know, Chicago's got a couple TVs out in the outfield that were live, and they show a picture of the catcher. You know, ours here in left field. Dave Roberts asked the umpires to turn that off because it was a live feed, and as a left-handed hitter, they felt you could see where the catcher was sitting. You know, just takes a short glance up there, so that's why that TV was turned off. So we have to be aware of the electronics and how it can impact the game.
Boy, interesting. Go ahead, Gary.
They had the next day
talking
after
to the mic.
Our thing
talking
happened.
To the mic. You got to talk into the mic.
Oh, the next day. I'm sorry. The next day after our deal. I was here at the game, and you guys had the deal. I've never seen anything like the catcher just stood there looking at your guy, and Chapman finally called him on it, I guess. Yeah. But that was something. I mean, and they thought you guys were peeking and looking at the. I mean, I knew you guys wouldn't, but another club might.
Sure. Well, yeah, I'll ask you this. I know we got to run here, but steals at second base, stealing signs at second base, does that go on all the time? Is that as prevalent as they want to make it out to be? Is that going on all the time?
Well, to like Gary's point, if you're not trying, you know, if you're not cheating, you're not trying. Not if you're not cheating, but if you're not trying to get an edge there, it's right there for you. And a lot of teams do it. I would say the majority of the teams do it. And not all the teams do it, because not every hitter wants the signs relayed to him. But it's an avenue to get an edge, which is legal. And it's going to continue to go. And we're always looking for it. Okay. Not only, we're always watching the runners out there. Rags is always watching the runners if we can see some. If you do, now you have to combat it. You got to change your sign or have the catcher set up inside to go outside. So you have to be aware of it and then counter it within the rules. And that's just part of the game.
All right. Well, last moment on this one. Al Worthington. Remember Al Worthington, Gary?
Sure.
Al Red Worthington. He was a relief pitcher for the Giants, Minnesota Twins, and other teams. Very good relief pitcher. Got traded to the Chicago White Sox. And didn't want to go because they had someone in the scoreboard at Comiskey Park with binoculars. And they would relay the signs to Nellie Fox or Aparicio or Jim Landis, whoever that was playing for the Sox in those times. And he was a very moral man. And he said, I'm not going. I am not going to play there because there's binoculars and some guys up there relaying the signs. So well, that
wasn't Thompson crushed when Branko crushed when he found out at a later, much when this book came out?
Sure, Branko Thompson. Branko always said, well, you know, but of course they made a whole career out of that one home run. And, you know, they it was, did you ever meet him? Well,
No, I have not.
Yeah, they made a whole career out of that home run. But Branko eventually said towards the end of his life, I knew you knew the pitcher was coming. You couldn't have hit it anyway.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of stuff. So I love it. You know, that's what connects us to the moments of the past of baseball. And we live it today every day because something will happen today.
Yeah, we do. I'll just leave you with this as I run off to get to work. But, you know, when Buck Showalter opened up in 98 in the new ballpark down in Arizona, for 2 years we were looking at those center field cameras and wondering if there was a light on or what. I mean, this goes on all the time, but that was a big issue because Buck had that reputation. He had 2 years to prepare, and he was always trying to get the edge. And their team was good, Gary, right? So you know when you're getting your butt kicked, and every time there's a guy on second, they're taking swings like they know what's coming. You're looking anywhere you can to find out how the heck are they doing this. And we've certainly watched a lot of teams this year because it's just part of the game.
I love it. All right, very good. Well, thanks for being with us. We'll see you. Only one more. That San Diego series, and that's it for us. And Gary Hughes, always a pleasure, the legend. And one day I'll tell you the story of why he is the legend.
Yeah, I'd like to hear that. It's great to see Gary here this morning.
One of the good stories.
All right, we'll be back with more right after this.